We certainly have conversations amongst ourselves about how different the weather seems from years ago. You know, things like summers didn't used to be this smoky or fire season used to start much later. But there aren't that many of us whose jobs and income depend directly on weather or the climate. Not so for people who grow grapes and make wine for a living. They have to be in tune with what nature gives them, and nature has been changing up the mix of late. That is the focus of the work of Dr. Greg Jones, a research climatologist and the director of wine education at Linfield College. He used to work at Southern Oregon University and moved north last year. No matter the base of operations, Dr. Jones is well-versed in what's happening to wine growers in many climates. Greg Jones, welcome back to The Exchange.
Well, thanks, Jeffrey. Good to be with you again.
So when you started at Southern Oregon University 21 years ago, was there such a thing as a wine climatologist?
Well, not necessarily. I was very fortunate when I was doing my graduate studies in Bordeaux that I just started doing something that very few people were actually doing back at that time, and that was being a climate scientist who was focusing solely on wine. I was able to do some of the type of research and observations that were needed, I think, to better kind of document the industry and be able to kind of help us understand better how wine grapes can be grown and made into great wine.
So by that point, we already knew that climate was changing. Was it in the forefront of what you were doing back then, or was it more just about getting a handle for what grows well where?
Well, a little bit of both. When I first started really thinking about how I was going to do research in my PhD, I was really looking at trying to better understand spatial variations on how, you know, grapes were grown in Bordeaux and what that meant for quality and production. And the more and more I looked into both Bordeaux, but also other places in the world, I kept finding that trends in climate appeared to be more prevalent and to some degree more important than the variability in the climate. And so I started looking at that a little bit more in depth. And so, yes, we've learned much more from about that early to mid-90 kind of framework that climates clearly have been changing in wine regions worldwide.
You know, I never bothered to ask this before, but you do like wine yourself?
Oh, yes, I do. Okay. Very much so. My first career, I was a sous chef, and I think that experience set me on a path to working a little bit in the wine sector, but also, you know, seeing wine as very much a part of food.
It is that. It is that indeed. So, do you ever feel much of, I mean, I imagine you still cook.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Let me come back to obviously wine and climate. I mean, wines can grow in lots of different climates, it seems. But, I mean, how sensitive are certain varieties of grapes to the growing conditions?
Well, we know that the vast majority of maybe, say, the top 15 to 20 international varieties, we have some pretty good data for them. And we know that many of them only have a few degrees of flexibility in how they can, where they can be grown from a climate perspective and how they can produce. If you have a given variety in its ideal climate, you're going to be much more consistent in terms of that productivity and quality. If it's too cold, of course, you're going to have issues of ripening, and the wine will likely not end up being balanced. But the same thing happens if it's too warm. You could end up in a situation in which you're ripening fruit, which ends up producing a wine that could be unbalanced as well.
So what works in the Willamette Valley, for example, would not be a great candidate for planting in the Rogue Valley and vice versa?
Well, it depends, because if you look at Southern Oregon and the Rogue Valley and all of the areas there, you can find elevations within the Rogue Valley that are suitable to growing varieties that are suitable in the Willamette Valley. And so there's a dependency upon how close you are to the coast, elevation, and kind of landscape variations that can do that. You know, Pinot Noir, being the marquee variety in the Willamette Valley, is grown pretty much throughout this area here. And it's also grown in Southern Oregon, but it's grown typically on the slightly cooler sites.
So you can find, even within any climate, even any microclimate, it sounds like, little pockets potentially where things might work better because of elevation or direction it faces, any of that stuff?
Sure. The entire Southern Oregon region, from the Umpqua Valley down through the Rogue Valley, has one of the most diverse climate landscapes for growing wine grapes in the world. And most of that has to do with the fact that there's quite a bit of elevation difference, and the distance to the coast and the mountains between the coast and the valleys are very important in terms of creating rain shadows and so on and so forth. So lot of diversity in terms of what the Southern Oregon region can produce.
I was going to ask you about that closeness to the coast part, because you mentioned that twice now, but that is generally just about how much precipitation makes it here from the coast?
Yeah, it's a little bit of that precipitation framework. So it creates a rain shadow. And of course, if you start up, like, say, at the northern part of the Umpqua Valley and come down to the Rogue Valley, the mountains get taller to the west of the Rogue Valley. So therefore, the rain shadow effects in the Rogue Valley are greater than they are in the Umpqua. But it's also not just the rainfall characteristics, but it does produce a difference in the magnitude of the heat in the summer and the coolness in the winter. Higher elevation areas that are more guarded from the coast are going to have colder winters than you might find, like, say, up in the Umpqua. But then again, in the summertime, places in the Rogue Valley are going to be a little bit warmer.
Is this because the relative humidities tend to be a bit lower as you go further south, or where the mountains are taller between the inland and the coast?
Correct. And you even see that up here in the Willamette Valley as you get closer to the Van Duzer Corridor, which is a corridor in the landscape toward the coast. The humidities go up just a little bit more, and so therefore the temperatures don't get quite as high.
We're talking to Greg Jones about wine and climate. He's a research climatologist and the director of wine education at Linfield College. He used to be at Southern Oregon University. And he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about these issues. You may join us. You can join us by phone at 800-838-3760 with your questions and comments. You can also send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Greg, how fast are the changes coming? And where are they in relation to any predictions you might have made about changes in climate?
Well, you know, I think the prediction piece of it is kind of interesting. Back when I first started really looking at kind of how were our climate models able to kind of predict things, and, you know, I would say that when we were producing models in the mid-90s that their ability to project the future was still into question. We really didn't quite know exactly how things would play out, but the models were giving us some insight into, you know, the potential. I've looked back at some of the work that we did in the late 90s, and it's interesting that the models were not that far off. And in some ways, and in some regions, they're actually projecting slightly lower than we've been observed to have over the past 5 to 10 years.
Lower in what sense?
Well, it's just that the models were projecting changes of, you know, 1 or 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit, and we've actually warmed in some places 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So you know, our models, I think, have of course gotten much, much better in terms of how we're able to do that with projections. But, you know, we still fine-tune these, and I think that there's a lot of work to really get a climate model to be as accurate as a meteorological model, for example.
So help people understand, because I've heard that take on it before, that, like, well, you know, 2 degrees Fahrenheit, so what? That's not a huge difference. But for a climate, how big a difference is that?
Well, it's a very big difference. And I think that most of our society, of course, is tied into our systems, our social systems. And for humans, 1 or 2 degrees tends not to be quite as important as it is to other organisms or plant species. You know, for example, a salamander in a riparian system in a mountain watershed is going to be much more sensitive to a 1 degree change than we would, you know, living where we do. And then plant species. Some plants really have a very finite kind of threshold in their climate. Coffee is a great example. Coffee needs to have high sunlight, but it needs to be relatively cool at certain times of year, and it needs to have consistent rain. If you don't get that, if it varies too much, then coffee plantations struggle in the tropical regions.
Is wine a little more flexible than that?
A little bit. But you have to think about the big issue with wine grapes is that the entire spectrum of wine grapes is relatively flexible to a mid-latitude climate. But when you start drilling down into each individual variety, given what we know about those varieties, we know that they don't produce across a very wide range. There are some that are very flexible. For example, Chardonnay, maybe Riesling, Cabernet Sauvignon, they tend to be a little bit more flexible, meaning that they have a wider climate regime that they can produce in. But when you get to some varieties, Pinot Noir, for one, is a fairly narrow climate variety. And there are many others that we don't know a lot about, but they look like they have very narrow climates, in such that if you see a 1 or 2 or 3 degrees change, it could put you completely out of the suitability for that variety.
Greg Jones, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a research climatologist and the director of wine education at Linfield College, and we're talking about climate and wine and how the one affects the other. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was reading about the Willamette Valley and the Van Duzer Corridor you mentioned specifically, and I get the sense here that the climate met the growers halfway.
Yes, it did. As a matter of fact, there's been a lot of attention to the Van Duzer Corridor, even such that the growers in that area have proposed to develop their own American viticulture area there.
Oh, it's a separate little zone there.
Yeah. And it's really because of the nature of the winds. We know that if you're in some of the hillsides around the Van Duzer Corridor, if you're protected from the winds, you get a little bit more heat and your ripening potential is a little different. If you're exposed to those winds, it's a little cooler. It's just a little different kind of framework. And that's the nature of these American viticulture areas, to be that a region has to be defined as being different in geology and soil, climate, and other characteristics.
So the AVA, there's one for the Umpqua Valley, is that right, and one for the Rogue Valley?
Yes, and then there's a broader Southern Oregon AVA, which is essentially the outer boundary of that area.
It's often what you'd expect, isn't it? Like, you know, you go up over this hill and then down, you know, the other steep side, and you're into a different AVA.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could visualize as we drive through a valley. It's pretty straightforward. And I'll give you the Illinois Valley is a good example. If you drive from Grants Pass down toward Cape Junction, it's pretty clear. You go over a mountain and boom, you're in the valley of around Cape Junction. Same thing could be said about the greater Bear Creek Valley as you drive from Grants Pass toward Medford. So there's a natural tendency for landscapes to produce these kind of environments. But we've also, in the wine industry, this has happened all over the world, that large areas like Bordeaux, for example, have been subdivided into many smaller areas because producers have noted for one reason or another, maybe it could be geology or soil characteristics, or maybe it's climate, that one place is a little more unique or different than another.
So I have to ask then, if as climate changes, if some growers are seeing this as an opportunity or at least a presentation of a suite of possibilities.
Well, I think a little bit of that is going on pretty much everywhere. There's clearly a lot of conversations around how cool climate areas have expanded worldwide. You know, the historic kind of framework in Europe was the 50-degree latitude was the limit, and the northern limit of viticulture in Europe, and that has expanded now. We have viticulture all the way up into Sweden, the Low Countries, England, and that's really driven by climate. And, you know, similar thing can be said about what we're seeing in parts of Canada, southern hemisphere. You go down to Tasmania and the southern tip down near Patagonia and Argentina. So we're definitely getting some expansion that wouldn't have occurred without some changes in climate.
Climatological is one thing. Economic is the other. I mean, are they making any money on Swedish wines? Are they building a reputation, for example?
Well, and that's kind of a definite point. There, you know, the industry in the Scandinavian region is not big. But, you know, there are pioneers there that are really testing those waters. And I think that they have a viable industry. It's an industry that still needs to find its place and what varieties do best and then how do they market that. But you're right, it's limited at the get-go. But they'll find their place. If the climates are conducive for them to ripen good fruit and make good wine, then they'll find that.
So certainly a shifting of possibilities here, but then there's also the volatility of the weather. I mean, we have single storms that dump 50 inches of rain in one place. I mean, events like this have to be concerning too.
Well, and I think this kind of does really get back to the issue that I saw many years ago, and I'm still a little concerned with, is that when we started doing our modeling, looking at how wine regions, climates worldwide were being affected by changes in temperature, we also found that variability in the climate, variability in the swings in temperature or individual events like freezes and frosts and or heat waves or heavy rain events, we noticed that the variability in those have gone up pretty much everywhere in the world, but definitely in wine regions. And so the challenge there is that a grower in a given region has to adapt their operation to average changes in climate over time. But these larger swings in variability, those are a little bit harder to play to. It's really hard to manage for a prolonged heat wave or a cold snap that, cold snaps still happen in a warming world. It's just that they're less frequent, but because they're less frequent, we're less prepared for them.
Well, and then I have to ask about the present circumstances. I mean, we have summers in regions that now get fairly regular heavy wildfire smoke. What does that do to the grapes and ultimately to the wine?
Well, we don't know all the answers with smoke taint, but there's a lot of research and effort going on to better understand it. The real issue is that any time you have a ripening fruit within a smoke environment, it has a potential to take up some of the volatile compounds that are in the atmosphere. With wine grapes, we know that there's some times a year that are very much more critical than other times in the year. For example, just after the grapes start, changing color and taking on sugar, typically in early to mid-August, we know that's a fairly critical period. And then the other piece of it is that we do understand that the smoke taint that occurs really doesn't manifest itself until after it gets fermented. Through the fermentation process, it takes the smoke compounds that have been taken up and converts them into a more of a, it's not even smoky, it's a lot of people consider it to be an ashtray kind of.
I was going to ask if ashy was the flavor, Yeah,
because I think a lot of people hear, well, there's a little smoke in the air, and so therefore we're going to have a smokier wine. That's not really what we're concerned with. We're concerned with what happens after fermentation and that ashtray kind of framework with it. Now, wine regions have had fire. Australia is a great example. We've always had fires, but we've tendency lately that summers have been hotter and drier, and we've just had a much more prevalence of fires that have been very problematic. And again, it just depends on some timing issues, how prolonged those smoke events are, and how far down into the landscape it is. If those smoke events are a little higher up in elevation in the atmosphere, then they probably will not affect the grapes as much, but they also will lower temperature because they'll reflect more light away. There's some great research that looked at a couple of different valleys a few years ago. One valley had a smoke level over it, and the other one didn't. And they found that the smoke lowered the daytime temperature by almost 2.5-3 degrees.
Oh, that'll be a difference for sure.
Yeah. So there's some interesting effects, but from the wine grower perspective, there's really not much you can do when you have a smoke event like that because you can't you can't blow it away, so to speak. But I think we really hope that you don't get a prolonged pall of smoke over a given area, especially during those critical times of the year.
Greg Jones, as I did some research and reading, it seems like that wine growers do get together and talk about climate. And one of the events was this fairly new thing called Bordeaux in America, that back in May. Is that about climate?
Yeah, there's down in Napa. There's a little bit of a concern about how certain varieties, and in this case, the conversation was around Cabernet Sauvignon, that there's been some observations that Cabernet Sauvignon in that environment has changed chemically overall, that the fruit is being ripened more or less to the same degree or more, but there's been some changes in what is called anthocyanins, which is essentially the color development, and that heat events or higher temperatures just overall have caused some of that to break down. And so there's a conversation going on in every region, but that the conference that we had down in Napa was really trying to talk about what kinds of characteristics are we seeing, and then how can we kind of change that or maybe adapt to it. And some of that has to happen in the vineyard, some of it has to happen in the winery, but at least the conversation's going on, and I think there's a lot of proactive things going on in the industry today.
And do you have the big Vitanord thing coming up in Europe soon?
Yes, we do. And that's the conference for the Scandinavian wine producers. And, I think the issue for places like that, that are the kind of these new fringe cool climate areas, is understanding what is the emerging nature of that climate. Does it provide stability in terms of ripening varieties in and out, in year in, year out? And then also, what varieties are going to perform the best? For example, in England, they have found that, of course, sparkling wines are very good in terms of their ability to produce the main varieties for sparkling. But they've also found a variety called Bacchus that's not grown very many places in the world that just happens to be very suitable to their relatively cool and wet climate.
Okay. And so all kinds of changes coming for sure as the climate goes in its direction. Dr. Greg Jones, Research Climatologist, Director of Wine Education at Linfield College. Always a pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
All right, take it easy.